Namaste. Welcome back. Tonight we return to Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother. And it's a happy occasion. Today is Krishna Janmashtami. It is the birthday of Krishna celebrated across India. And now it is the morning of the 3rd of September in India, and hence is the birthday of Sri T.V. Kapali Shastriya, one of the great early disciples of Sri Aurobindo, who was a tantric, a Vedantin, and an integral yogin. You can find many of his books still luminous and mellifluously written. You don't necessarily have to pay for them. I'll give you a tip. You can go to archive.org, O-R-G, and find many of his works available there in their original edition. They have been often subsequently reprinted. Unfortunately, the editorial standards have slipped, and I would refer you back to the original editions, and if you don't mind reading them on your iPad or your favorite tablet or on your computer, then you can have them without expense to you just by searching. Sri T.V. Kapali Shastriya. Last week, we were noting that the book The Mother was published in 1928, but the first chapter was a message released on the birthday of the mother, formerly known as Mira Richard, before that as Mira Alfasa. It was the first signal occasion that Sri Aurobindo had the chance to prepare something to put before the group who had gathered around him to practice collective yoga, to practice what was a full yoga, an affirmative yoga, which came to be called Purna Yoga, an integral yoga. It was consequent to earlier events. You'll remember that Mira, who became the mother, had come back to Pondicherry to rejoin Sri Aurobindo in this large, world-changing effort in April of 1920. She stayed behind the scenes for a long time. Sri Aurobindo was at the front. Slowly that dynamic began to shift. He receded more and more, giving way to her, and she came forward and effectively had been given charge of the conduct of that community by the time of his birthday in 1926, a few days after perhaps she essentially took it over and then fully took it over on the 24th of November 1926, when the consciousness of Krishna, representing the overmind as it presents to the universe, the Anandamaya, the world of delight, came flooding into Sri Aurobindo's physical consciousness. He would later clarify that it was not the complete, the perfect overmental creation in his physique at that very moment, but essentially so, that it was substantially true. So today we speak about Krishna's birthday, in a sense. He has another birthday every year like this, but he had a great birthday when he greeted the Earth in 1926, consenting to be a fulsome part, a real partner in the Earth's evolution of a greater consciousness, to go beyond what he had achieved in establishing the overmental principle in the Earth atmosphere thousands of years earlier. Now he is a full partner, aiding and abetting and encouraging Sri Aurobindo to develop a yoga that could transform life. A very different goal from any yoga then being practiced in India or anywhere. So this message is a clarion call. We read it aloud last week. And best to let Sri Aurobindo speak with his own force. So perhaps each time we'll try to read either the whole of a chapter or a significant part of the chapter without an interruption, and we'll come back and comment about it afterwards. But let's hear the music of his language. Let's feel the power of his mantra. So last week, we were looking at how the assembly around him was coming into congruence to practice this collective yoga. It wasn't simply a yoga that Sri Aurobindo practiced and he radiated its truth. Everyone was practicing at once, with him and with the mother. Not everyone had a clear understanding of who she was or what she represented. But it was clear that they were a cohesive group. There were around 24 people when the Siddhi occurred, the fulfillment occurred on the 24th of November. She writes to her son Andre a few months later, in January and February, that now there are about 30. So already the ashram is beginning to grow. The sense of what Sri Aurobindo had achieved had been communicated to aspirants in Bengal and Gujarat and elsewhere, and they were beginning to petition for permission to come. May we participate in this yoga? Mother and Sri Aurobindo carefully assessed, what is the nature of the consciousness? What is the nature of the capacity to endure a very arduous yoga? This isn't the invitation into a field of secret felicities indrawn in seclusion. You're practicing yoga in the raw currents of life's largest streams. So you'll feel the turbulence of life. Do you have the force within? Do you have the vehicle prepared to take this yoga up? Some would come and some would go. Not everybody came to the ashram and remained for the rest of their lives. If you've had that notion, please set that aside. There are many who came and found that they could not practice this yoga. They really sought something else or felt keenly the call to go back to family. So this clarion call that is issued on the mother's birthday says very little about her, but very much about what is the real work. And you can see that without even defining it at first, the whole project is about transformation. Let's look at the language again. This is about the urgency of this collective effort. There are two powers that alone can affect in their conjunction the great and difficult thing which is the aim of our endeavor, a fixed and unfailing aspiration that calls from below, and a supreme grace from above that answers. What a sentence. The fixed and unfailing aspiration. We've just read The Life Divine. Do you remember the title of the first chapter? The Human Aspiration. Without that aspiration, there is no movement. If there is nothing stirring within the earth, then there is no advance in consciousness, in the evolution towards divinity. The human power of aspiration is a partner in this endeavor. The other, a supreme grace from above. Now, we can use Sanskrit words if we like. One word for aspiration is abhipsa. A word for grace in Sanskrit, well, there are several really, anugraha, which means to reach out and grasp that which comes and picks you up, that plucks you out of difficulty, that holds your hand and helps you along. That is a term that is very familiar to those who read the Bhagavata Purana. The term that appears more often in the Bhagavad Gita, however, is prasada. And prasad is something that, of course, ashramites are very familiar with because they all hold their hands like this and receive prasad. They get something that they like. They collect some felicity. But prasada has two sides to it. Prasad is something first that the human offers. I gather my experience from life. I gather what wisdom I have, what wealth I have, what I am, what I wish to be, and I offer it. And in offering it, the divine accepts and then responds. And that is the other side of prasad. That is the descent. It's a response from love, a response that enlightens, ennobles, felicitates the person who is waiting to receive. And so here, an aspiration that calls from below and a supreme grace from above that answers. That describes it perfectly. But it also could be described, grace could also be described in Sanskrit as kripa, which is a favorite term in South Indian devotionalism because it puts the emphasis on the doing. It's an act. It's not simply a posture where one receives inwardly. It's a force in progress. And so all of these things can answer to what that grace is in a way. But Sri Aurobindo has written the term grace in English. So let's take it at that and feel it, and we come to know it best when we experience it. Remember, that's the watchword of the life divine. It's a wonderful thing to study and to develop philosophic discrimination and to see a truth. But until you have experienced it, until it's real to you, it is incomplete. Incomplete. That's the first sentence. But the supreme grace will act only in the conditions of the light and the truth. It will not act in conditions laid upon it by the falsehood and the ignorance. For if it were to yield to the demands of the falsehood, it would defeat its own purpose. Now, Sri Aurobindo is not writing philosophy in this message. Even the 24 or 30 people who were present for the distribution of this message. May not all have gone through his life-divine synthesis of yoga essays on the Gita, which existed there as sets of the Arya in those days. Unrevised, but still there. Not all were trying to understand Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. But here, he has expressed something that he unrolled in the Life Divine over the course of hundreds of pages. The grace from above is not something that comes from the top of our mind. It comes from a region of a true consciousness. And when he says it will act in the conditions of light and truth, it means in its own conditions. For that grace to act, for us to call it and receive it and have it become fully effective in us, means that we have to set the conditions for it here, that we have to establish the principle of light and truth here, as opposed to falsehood and ignorance. Well, fortunately, Sri Aurobindo has not left us wondering about what this means, because he's written about it in his correspondence. So I will take the opportunity to read his explanation. Falsehood and ignorance. Ignorance means avidya, the separative consciousness and the egoistic mind and life that flow from it, and all that is natural to the separative consciousness and the egoistic mind and life. This ignorance is the result of a movement by which the cosmic intelligence separated itself from the light of the supermind, the divine gnosis, and lost the truth. Truth of being, truth of divine consciousness, truth of force and action, truth of Ananda. As a result, instead of a world of integral truth and divine harmony created in the light of the divine gnosis, we have a world founded on the part truths of an inferior cosmic intelligence in which all is half truth, half error. It is this that some of the ancient thinkers like Shankara, not perceiving the greater truth force behind, stigmatized as Maya and thought to be the highest creative power of the divine. All in the consciousness of this creation is either limited or else perverted by separation from the integral light. Even the truth it perceives is only a half knowledge. Therefore, it is called the ignorance. Falsehood, on the other hand, is not this avidya, but an extreme result of it. It is created by an asuric power which intervenes in this creation and is not only separated from the truth and therefore limited in knowledge and open to error, but in revolt against the truth, or in the habit of seizing the truth only to pervert it. This power, the dark asuric shakti, or rakshasic maya, puts forward its own perverted consciousness as true knowledge, and its willful distortions or reversals of the truth as the verity of things. It is the powers and personalities of this perverted and perverting consciousness that we call hostile beings, hostile forces. Whenever these perversions created by them out of the stuff of the ignorance are put forward as the truth of things, that is the falsehood in the yogic sense, mithya, moha. So, the supramental consciousness is in its own realm a vast and perfect creation. But as it takes its oneness and its integrality and throws into harmonic diversity its potential, and then leans into the diversity with the oneness at the back, it creates the potential of a further involution of itself, where the diversity becomes paramount and the unity is, as it were, lost. And that becomes the overmind, where still there is massive, massive consciousness, globality of view, but each truth, in a sense, has its own force and doesn't recognize that it's constellated with all others. It sees all others in the terms of its own perspective and its own wideness. And so, as the evolution or the involution continues, you see this separative force continue to enact itself and arrive at farther and farther ranges of extension, but having lost the intimate oneness that truly binds them. Can it ever be lost, really? No. But we can ignore it, and that is what ignorance is. We have ignored the essential truth of things. And now, having ignored it and allowed that involution to proceed into the inconscient, the whole process of evolution is to build up and recapture it an element at a time. So we begin materially, and then we live vitally, and then we begin to think mentally and bring all of this back into an upward moving fusion. Still disparate, still discordant, but looking for harmony, looking for that delight, looking for that luminous world. Called to it. We're restless. We can't seize until we get back to that. So still we work upon it. And yet, ignorance has its sway. And the powers that recognize that they succeed by division, well, they seem to be in charge of the world. And they seem to take this form and that form. Really, their formation is in consciousness. And we call them by these great names. You know, Asura means the elder one, the elder gods who had great power. Original emanations, as we'll talk about later, coming from the mother, and she has to put forward other children to do combat with them and sustain the ultimate harmony that the cosmos intends to achieve. We won't get lost in a discussion about these powers and appearances right now, but let's read farther. So avidya means not knowledge, right? So that is ignorance. Mithya means falsehood. That's an actual mistake based upon ignorance. These are the conditions of the light and truth. The sole conditions under which the highest force will descend. And it is only the very highest supramental force descending from above and opening from below that can victoriously handle the physical nature and annihilate its difficulties. There must be a total and sincere surrender. There must be an exclusive self-opening to the divine power. There must be a constant and integral choice of the truth that is descending, a constant and integral rejection of the falsehood of the mental, vital, and physical powers and appearances that still rule the earth nature. So our Dr. Rostogi, after our first session last Sunday, sent me an email to clarify if this physical nature that is described here refers to the material world and not to what would correspond to the same thing in the higher nature. He's correct. This is an element referred to here in what in Sanskrit we would call prakriti. The higher nature, the supreme nature, is para-prakriti. So there is a distinction, and we'll be coming to that in subsequent pages. So here, surrender, self-opening, choose the truth, and to reject the things that would pull you towards them into a trap. You remember the conversation that Yama had with Nachiketas in the Katha Upanishad, where he, the Lord of Death, tries to get Nachiketas to accept a very appealing offer. I can give you kingdoms, I can give you beautiful wives, I can make you wealthy. Don't ask me this question about the nature of eternity, why the soul is immortal. Please let me seduce you with these things. And Nachiketas says, no, there will never be anyone like you again to teach me. This you have promised, and this I ask. And then Yama, pleased with him, says, the wise man, and will walk around an object to examine it. He will discriminate between the pleasant and the good. He will walk all the way around before he chooses to know what it is that he's looking at. And Nachiketas, you have so chosen. And because you cleave to truth, I will teach you. And then he teaches him both the nature of the subtle worlds, the truth of the cosmos, and the truth of the essential reality from which the cosmos comes. And he said to Nachiketas, would that I could always meet such a one as you, Nachiketas. That aspirant is rare. Sri Aurobindo, here in this passage, is calling for his aspirants who have gathered around him to really practice the yoga that he intends. The whole thing, this aspiration and grace, aim at transformation. He is not going to be content with a Vedantic solution to the world problem, to realize the essence of Brahman and then quit the cosmos. Sri Aurobindo, as you can see, is insisting that we descend into the nadir of the difficulty and wrestle it out. Here's something interesting. He writes about the supramental force descending from above and opening from below. This is his message, 21 February 1927. In what we commonly call now the record of yoga, he had a note written down in January of 1927, about a month before, in which he's making comment about his effort to transform his body by renouncing food. In other words, to install energy in his system from superphysical forces and sources. He writes, the attempt, therefore, was premature. In order that it should succeed, one of two things was necessary. Either a I I can't read my own handwriting. Either a right entire knowledge and process, or else the divine grace supporting a complete descent of the highest supramental truth and a complete ascent to meet it of the supramental from below. So in other words, in both of these passages, his letter to himself and this message to his disciples, the idea that there is a supramental force that must come from the highest heights above and from its hidden recesses below, the same supramental, and where they form a nexus, that will annihilate the difficulties. So his note made it into the message. And in the doing so, the reliance on the yogic force and not upon the apparent assistance of the vehicle is what is paramount here. It is again that conjunction of the supramental above and the supramental below that takes care, that works to resolve the discords in mind, life, and body. They must aspire. We must make a wholesale conversion in how we approach the prospect of yoga in our mind, in our feeling, in how we power our lives, in how we conduct all these processes through the body, but that isn't where the real work happens. It's happening in our capacity to communicate with and be in contact with these powers above and below as they open. That's the real engine for success. So the solution, therefore, is not within the outer structure of the lower nature in Prakriti. It is not to be found in mind, life, and matter. It is in restoring the integrity of our consciousness. And the only thing that really has that integrity in a dynamic way is the supramental. It originates that in taking the infinity of Satchit Ananda and distributing it into harmonic cosmos above. It has to create that here, and it can only create that here if the supramental rises from behind its masked zone of defense in this world. So the supramental is already here. It is that that unmasks it as it wishes to emerge. Does it make sense to you? Let's see if we can get another paragraph in. The surrender must be total and sees all the parts of the being. It is not enough that the psychic should respond and the higher mental accept, or even the inner vital submit and the inner physical consciousness feel the influence. There must be in no part of the being, even the most external, anything that makes a reserve, anything that hides behind doubts, confusions, and subterfuges, anything that revolts or refuses. So he is writing to the members of his ashram. challenging them to go beyond the brilliance of their inner experiences. You'll remember if you've read Purani's descriptions of the context of the evening conversations that he wrote down, if you've read what was going on in the life of the ashram in Anil Baran Roy's notations or Pavitra's notations, that there was no dearth of experience, that there were many people who had registered strong periods of illumination, even realizations. Sri Aurobindo later commented that these realizations and experiences were in the main limited to the mind and the inner being. What he's described here, of course, is what we would come to know in the life divine as the subliminal range, the higher mind. You can't get to the higher mind if you haven't been to the inner mind. To get to that, the higher mental accept, inner vital. Most people live in the surface vital. To discover and find the true vital within is to push inside, to get through that velamen that separates the outer construct of the personality from the realities of the subliminal nature which lie within and which can enrich our life in every way. And then, of course, the inner physical consciousness. One can feel the gladdening effect of a wide consciousness, the impact that it has on the body, the capacity that comes into it. It can work indefatigably. It can be happy. The body becomes aware of its own possibilities, no more dull and inert and simply a slave to the will of the vital or the behest of the mind. All of these things are important, but that is not what Sri Aurobindo is interested in. He's interested in a wholesale change, that the surrender that he spoke about at the beginning has to seize all the parts. What is the surrender? A sincere surrender is the offering of the whole nature. It is not the surrender in a martial sense. It's not that you've been conquered by the divine. It's that you've recognized that you are a part of that. It's easy in that way for that drop of milk to come back into the ocean of milk, especially if it knows that it won't be annihilated, that it continues as a drop, as part of the ocean. This is the beauty of the supramental consciousness as opposed to the realization available through Vedanta and its normal techniques, which abolishes individuality. Here, individuality is subsumed into universality and essentiality without abrogation of its real status, because the individual exists in that. It is an aspect of the transcendent. That transcendent throws itself out as universe, as individual, and as the cosmicized individual eventually. So here, Sri Aurobindo is insisting that this offering be part of the entire nature, that mind and heart and energy and body all participate in that. Now, we've only read a portion of this first chapter tonight, but you can see, what would the ashram feel like having received this challenge? This takes them out of anything they thought they were practicing. If they thought they were practicing bhakti yoga or jnana yoga or karma yoga or any of them in combination, then the scales have just been taken from their eyes, because this is a bigger prospect. This is a cosmic yoga. You're doing it not for you. You're not even doing it for the universe. You're doing it for that. And you're trying to find within yourself all that denies the advent of that so that you can expose it to light and it be changed in the light's effulgence. Well, I think that's enough for an evening. We'll continue to work in chapter one next time. And again, if you have questions, you're welcome to send them to me by email. And I will never blame you if you desist from joining us, although we delight in having you with us. I think I'll read a passage from Savitri tonight. This is from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. This is the opening of Canto 12, The Heavens of the Ideal. Always the ideal beckoned from afar. Awaken by the touch of the unseen, deserting the boundary of things achieved, aspired the strong discoverer, tireless thought, revealing at each step a luminous world. It left known summits for the unknown peaks. Impassioned, it sought the lone unrealized truth. It longed for the light that knows not death and birth. Each stage of the soul's remote ascent was built into a constant heaven felt always here. At each pace of the journey marvelous, a new degree of wonder and of bliss, a new rung formed in being's mighty stair, a great wide step trembling with jeweled fire as if a burning spirit quivered there, upholding with his flame the immortal hope, as if a radiant God had given his soul that he might feel the tread of pilgrim feet mounting in haste to the Eternal's house. At either end of each effulgent stair, the heavens of the ideal mind were seen in a blue lucency of dreaming space, like strips of brilliant sky clinging to the moon. On one side glimmered hue on floating hue, a glory of sunrise breaking on the soul in a tremulous rapture of the heart's insight and the spontaneous bliss that beauty gives, the lovely kingdoms of the deathless rose. Above the spirit cased in mortal sense, our superconscious realms of heavenly peace. Below, the inconscient's sullen, dim abyss. Between, behind our life, the deathless rose. Across the covered air, the spirit breathes. A body of the cosmic beauty and joy unseen, unguessed, by the blind suffering world, climbing from nature's deep surrendered heart, it blooms forever at the feet of God, fed by life's sacrificial mysteries. Here too, its bud is born in human breasts. Then, by a touch, a presence, or a voice, the world is turned into a temple ground, and all discloses the unknown beloved. In an outburst of heavenly joy and ease, life yields to the divinity within and gives the rapture offering of its all, and the soul opens to felicity. A bliss is felt that never can wholly cease. A sudden mystery of secret grace flowers, goldening our earth of red desire. Thank you again for coming. Namaste. Jai Ma.